This is Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. The Storyteller. Hello and welcome to episode 86 of T. Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Dave, and I am joined this week, as every week, by someone who can tell a story like no other. Not literally. Everyone is better than he is. It's my good friend Yannick. Hi, Yannick. How are you?
Hi, Dave. I'm fine, thank you. I am now fully vaccinated, so I can get 5G too. I'm fine. The vacations are coming up in a few weeks, so everything is absolutely perfect.
Excellent. Here. That's really, really good to hear. Vaccinations and vacations. There's a reason they are spelled so similar.
Yes, and there's a reason why they're in that order.
Yes, very much so. Anywho, on tonight's show, we're going to be reviewing Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Season 1, Episode 14, The Storyteller. Very interesting episode this week.
Indeed. Mm. Indeed.
Well, unless you've got anything else to waffle on about this part of the show.
No, I don't.
Then let's crack on with The Storyteller. So, in the teaser, the Bajoran government has asked Benjamin Sisko to mediate a disagreement between two rival factions. As he's busy preparing to receive the Paku and Navot delegations, another issue has come up with O'Brien. The chief has been assigned to pilot a runabout to Bajor, but he casually tries to find an excuse to get out of it, offering Ensign Boyer as a replacement. When his travel companion enters, Dr. Bashir, it is obvious why O'Brien does not want to go. He does not like Bashir, who is utterly oblivious to this fact. Chief O'Brien, I feel your pain.
Yes, yeah. I was wondering, you know, at the beginning, why doesn't he want to go? And then when Bashir enters, I said, why. Okay.
No, I thought it was something a little bit more substantial, like he had a date with the missus, or there was an anniversary coming up, or there was I didn't realize it was just because Julian was going.
Yeah.
Doctor, please call me Julian Bashir.
Yes. I don't know if O'Brien doesn't like Bashir, or if he just doesn't want to be, you know, in a shuttlecraft for I don't know how many hours, and knowing that Bashir talks a lot.
I suppose you have to be in a certain frame of mind to tolerate Bashir.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I've not found that yet.
Nope.
Bashir and O'Brien have been told there is a medical emergency in a village on Bajor, although the nature of the emergency is uncertain. Sisko leaves O'Brien stuck with Bashir, leaving them in the turbo lift to greet the newly arrived leader of the Paku. When they get there, they meet Tetrarch Varys Sul, a 15-year-old girl.
Ta-da-da! They seem surprised.
Yeah, well, I know that each civilization and culture is different, but I suppose it's a shock to the system of a... You know, I was about to use the phrase civilized society, and that really isn't what I meant. But in most societies, the leaders of factions or communities tend to be on the other end of the age scale.
Yes, I agree. Mm. Especially since, you know, we've been told it's for very important negotiations and you know, the future of Bajor and all that, and all of a sudden this 15-year-old girl shows up and says, "Hey, I'm one of the two negotiators."
Right.
I have to say I was surprised too.
So I wonder if the leader of the other faction is wearing nappies still.
That is possible.
Okay, let's go straight into Act 1 then. During the 2-hour trip to Bajor, Bashir tries to make small talk, but O'Brien gives him the cold shoulder. Bashir does ask O'Brien not to call him Sir, but to use his first name, Julian, which he reluctantly agrees to.
Common in military or I know the Federation is not military, but it's the closest thing we have to socialize with.
I suppose so. I mean, when you're in a runabout going from A to B, getting from there to here, should I say, then it's, I suppose you don't really need a military or official command environment, do you? You're going to be going on a...
Yeah.
Did it say how long the journey was?
2 hours.
2 hours. So you're going on a 2-hour journey with somebody, and you want to make that journey go as smoothly as possible. So you kind of dispense with all formality and the like.
I don't know what rank Bashir has.
He is a he's either a lieutenant or a junior lieutenant. I cannot remember which. He must be a lieutenant because he's a... he would be classified as bridge crew, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
So, I the thing I struggled with was getting my head around the idea that Bashir is actually O'Brien's senior officer.
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
We don't know where Chief stands in the hierarchy.
Actually, we do. Chief, in this case, stands for Chief Petty Officer. And he has one filled pip on his uniform.
Okay. Okay.
Whereas a lieutenant has two empty pips. So theoretically, so higher rank.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't see, you know, Picard and Riker in the shuttlecraft and Picard asking Riker to call him Jean-Luc during TNG, because that never happened, I think.
No, but I think that
happened in Picard, but...
Yes, but that would be more down to Riker than it would be to Picard, because Picard, in a non-command environment, Picard would always call Riker Will.
Yes, in that sense, in that direction, I understand, but...
So it's not Picard here, that's got a problem with familiarity. It would have been Riker that had a problem with familiarity in the presence of his commanding officer.
I don't see Picard asking Riker to call him Jean-Luc, even for 2 hours.
I think you are right.
I don't really understand why
J.L.
Bashir said that. J.L. Yeah.
No. They beam to the surface to meet the villagers' magistrate, Farron Cag, but find no signs of disease, despite Farron's claim that the village is in danger of extinction. A man, simply called the Seerer, is dying, and Farron believes that they will all die with him. Confused, Bashir gets to work. But how he can get to work when he doesn't know what the problem is, I don't know.
Yeah. And this set obviously was recycled from the original series. It's funny, as we said 2 weeks ago or last week, I don't remember, as soon as there's a scene on a planet or somewhere outside of the station, they seem to have very low budget for the for the set, as they have probably, you know, put all the money on the DS9 set. So
yes, I wonder if they have this kind of game of set bingo, where they have a list of all the sets that were created in the original series, and they tick them off every time they reuse it within TNG or DS9.
this set has been used only 3 times. We need one more. Write an episode to use this set.
But every time they do use it, the cost of their production goes down because if you use it in one, then you're paying the entire cost of that set for production. If you use it twice, you're paying half the cost.
Yeah, see?
Canny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And it's also, you know, it's always the same with any science fiction series, is that when they beam down to a village, it seems that it's the only village of the planet. You know, they never go outside, and they barely talk about outsiders, and it's like there's one village per planet. I mean, it was the same in Stargate when they arrived somewhere. They arrived maybe in the forest or in some lost places, and then find a village and stay there. And it seems to the life on the planet seems to be around that village.
I suppose that's how they keep their costs down. Because they only have to build one village rather than multiple villages.
Yeah, I guess. And it's easier to write a story.
I suppose so, yes. Although we are... Have we got this far yet? Yes, we have. We're just about to meet the fact that we have two different communities of people separated by a boundary. So technically... There are two villages, technically.
That's on Bajor. That's the two Bajoran communities.
Oh, sorry. Yes. We're changing.
So we know Bajor is a big planet with lots of people.
Yes. Well, let's get to that bit.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, Varys and the Navot leader, Woban, meet with Sisko and Kira. They explain they have had a treaty for 90 years and that it declares the boundary between their people a designated river, the Glirond. However, during the occupation, the Cardassians diverted the river for their mining operations and caused 20 kilometres of land to shift from Navot to Paku control. While Woban claims that the land is still his, Varys believes the original boundary, the river, still stands. So this 20 kilometres of land, are they talking 20 kilometres of boundary, so 20 kilometres of length boundary, or 20 kilometres deep of land? Because 20 kilometres is a hell of a long deep. Way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very long way to divert a river.
It is.
I agree. So it's probably 20 kilometres long on, I don't know how many.
Yeah.
How many meters? Because even a full kilometer to divert a river, a full kilometer, that's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, a kilometer, it's a huge amount of. But I suppose that the Cardassians, if they felt that it was within their interest to do so, and there was, you know, a decent enough justification, and I suppose profit in order to be made from it, then yeah. 20 kilometres probably isn't that far.
No. Well, I guess they just throw that number on paper and say, oh, let's roll with 20.
Yeah, 20 kilometres.
Why not?
Yeah, well, we don't know that a kilometre on Bajor is the same as a kilometre on Earth. You know, hours in a day.
I would think it's, the same as, you know, time and stuff like that. The Universal Translator did translate the unit and the number by magic because, well, it is magic.
Yeah, well, of course it is.
Yeah, we said that 2 weeks ago, I think, in the recording. So,
yes. It's one of those things we're required to accept that the Universal Translator is just a fact. And that's why everybody speaks with an American accent.
Absolutely.
Well, except those that speak with a English or Irish or... Moving on.
Move along home.
Quark enters the room and, a little too cheerfully, serves pre-ordered drinks to the delegates, including a Trixian bubble juice for the little lady, who takes offence at being called that and then empties the glass over Quark. He is still going to charge her for that drink, though.
Yeah, But I wouldn't expect less from Quark.
No, absolutely. Jake and Nog are sitting at their usual railing, bored. Jake wants to go play baseball in the holosuite, but Nog is finding more entertainment by throwing small stones at passers-by below. Odo turns up and suggests, rather pointedly, that Jake and Nog can see the promenade just as well without their legs dangling over the promenade. Suddenly, Nog becomes distracted by something, and, watching Varys walks by, he is love-struck.
Ta-da! Yeah, it was visible on his face.
Yes.
Yeah, I liked how Odo is looking over the two youngsters. You know, he could have easily, you know, send them or maybe, you know, called their dads or stuff. But he's like, you know, I think he knows that they are bored, that there are not a lot of children on the station, so he's getting them some slack.
Yeah, and I think he enjoys bossing them around a little bit.
Yeah, I think so.
There is, of course, the health and safety aspect of, you know, small children dangling legs over the end of the promenade. And whilst I appreciate that they can't go anywhere because the railings are in the way, if you get somebody who is particularly tall walking through the promenade, they're going to end up getting kicked in the head by one or possibly two children.
Yes.
Which is,
and there's always the possibility that they can slip, you know, if they fall on their back, they can still go through the rails and
That is true.
Fall.
That is true. Although I'm not sure, I don't know if I should say this or not. It's a bit rude. it would be unlikely that Nog's head would fit through that gap in the bottom of the railings.
True. That is true.
Sorry, people, it's a fact.
It is. It is.
Back on Bajor, Bashir finishes his scan when the Seer awakes. He cries about something called the Dal Rock and calls for his apprentice, Hoveth. He tries to get out of bed, but Bashir stops him. Suspecting the prophets have sent him, he feels for his pach, but doesn't see it. He calls for his companion, so O'Brien comes over. This time, curiously, he is pleased. Now, wasn't this kind of the same exchange that happened between Sisko and the Kai in Emissary?
No.
No?
It's I don't think it was that same thing, or at least it was not the same reaction, because he was indeed very pleased to see O'Brien, as if it was waiting for him.
But the Kai was waiting for Sisko.
Yeah.
All right, maybe not exactly the same circumstance, but I think it was the same connection, perhaps, between the two individuals.
Probably,
maybe.
Yeah.
The Seer dismisses them, and Bashir explains to the leader outside that he is suffering system-wide organ failure from old age, and there's nothing he can do. Dismayed, he explains the Dal Rock, a terrible creature, will threaten the village that night, and only the Seer can save them.
Ooh. Yeah, very... I was going to say confusing. It's not confusing, but concerning prophecy, you can say.
Yes.
But the Dal Rock... although it's, I'm going to say that later. I don't want to spoil that episode.
Fair enough. Okay, so we're on Act 2. Back on the station, Nog takes Jake to Varys' quarters, but neither has the nerve to ring the doorbell, and they begin arguing. Suddenly, the door is opened. Varys no doubt was checking to see what the commotion was all about.
Yeah, they were arguing at the door. So
yeah, but they were shouting.
But you would think on a space station the door would be like, you know, thick enough. It's not like a cheap motel or something. It's a space station.
Yeah,
where miners probably Kardashian officials who are leaving, so they, I'm pretty sure the door is really the doors are really thick.
Yeah, I mean, if it's reasonably quiet inside, and somebody's making a terrible racket like those two were directly outside the door, it probably does carry through.
Yeah, true.
I think
the door still. Yeah, the door still make squeaking noise. So they're probably not very well isolated either.
No. Jake and Nog, especially Nog, nervously stumble over their words to offer Varys a tour of the station, mentioning that a Klingon freighter is leaving for the Gamma Quadrant through the wormhole. With a little hint of a smile, she accepts the tour.
Yeah.
I've got to say, though, I think she was ballsy. Really, really ballsy. I mean,
I think she was... Go ahead.
They stood there arguing because neither of them had the courage to ring knock on the door. And yet, the moment they're inside, because they invited themselves inside, which was a little bit concerning in itself. In fact, they didn't. They just walked in. And then you couldn't shut them up.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember how I was. How I was at their age, but it didn't shock me that much. I think she was happy to find a person of her age.
Yes.
because, she's the representative of the, I don't remember which one of the, which faction, but Deep down inside, she's still a child, so I guess she was happy to find someone her age.
She is the Paku.
Yes.
Yes, she is of the Paku.
Yes.
That night, against Dr. Bashir's medical advice, the Seerer insists that he be allowed to tell the story as a dark cloud forms over the village. Although no atmospheric disturbance or energy discharge can be found with any of the tricorders. He stands on a rock where all the villagers can look at him as his back is to the cloud. He begins to give an inspirational speech which lifts the heart of the villagers and causes some sort of energy beam to rise up from the village. This seems to push the ominously close cloud back, but the Seerer finally collapses. As he does so, the beam stops and the villagers panic. Without his help, the cloud, the Dalrock of their legend, fires a lightning-like beam and injures several people.
Yeah. Nasty stuff.
Yeah, not nice. Wouldn't want to be caught by that.
Nope.
And go on.
And the fact that O'Brien couldn't see anything on the tricorder, that was even stranger. Because how do you protect people or protect yourself from something you don't know anything about, so.
Well, I think that's the thing that caught me out, because I originally thought that because it couldn't be detected on the tricorder, that it wasn't actually there. It was some kind of illusion. Yeah, but when it starts shooting things at people and knocking them over, that's there.
Yeah.
So my quote of the week happened in this scene. It's two words. Okay. It's very, very O'Brien. Bloody hell! I mean,
yeah, it's very Scotty too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's I know the Scots and the Irish have got a lot of things in common. Please don't send any hate mail for that. But
I was going to say it, but you said it, instead. So that's okay.
I suppose what they're trying to do here, and I've seen it so many times before, is they try and insert a lot of Britishisms, a lot of British English elements in when they can, because you would never hear an American actor or an American character uttering the words "bloody hell." It's such a bloody British hell thing to say.
Yeah. Well, Colmine is. He's Irish.
Yes.
Is he?
He is, yes.
Yes. So, I guess the Americans are, and no offense to any American viewers or listeners, but they do like, as Nate is a real example of that, they do like European accents.
Mm.
And so they would fit Englishisms. I don't know if that's a word, but...
It is now. It is now. I like that. Englishisms. It is now. Yes.
And there's some Englishisms in there. Just for fun.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Although I find it really weird that a country that has such a wide variety of accents, depending on where in the country you are, likes Europeans for their accents.
Well, why not? I mean...
Well, it's no accounting for taste, is there?
Yeah.
All right, so we're on to Act 3. Almost halfway through. Well, we're not. We're nowhere near halfway through the episode. The latest acts are longer again.
Mm-hmm.
Bashir and O'Brien help the Seerah to his feet, and he asks for his successor. Not Hovath, his prior apprentice, though. He wants O'Brien. Urgently, the Seerah dictates what O'Brien should say, and has him tell the story of how the village is stronger than the Dal Rock. The villagers rejoice as the cloud-like formation is pushed away and disappears. Immediately thereafter, the Seerah collapses, and Farron proclaims O'Brien the new Seerah, much to O'Brien's shock.
Yeah, he was like, what? What? And no.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are looking for a new chief engineer. Well, yeah. If anybody is out of their place at this moment in time, it's O'Brien. He's not comfortable at all.
No. I guess if they had said that it was Bashir, he would have liked that. I'm pretty sure he would have. I don't know if he would have made a good Seerah, but he would have liked to be named the new Seerah.
He would have made a great storyteller.
Yeah,
you know,
probably.
Playing to the crowds, that's his dream. Well, I don't know, maybe I'm making that up, but that certainly appears to be his dream, having the mm-hmm. attention of the people.
Absolutely.
In Sisko's office, he confronts Varys about the last long round of unproductive talks. Bluntly, he asks whether she's there to talk or start a war, since she's been wasting everybody's time up to this point. She insists that the land belongs to the Paku, despite claims otherwise. He asks if her people are as ready to die for the land as she seems to be, but then she storms out.
Yeah, childish. Childish behaviour.
Yeah, everything. So many things she's done so far have been very indicative of how old she actually is. The way she shouted at Quark for calling her a little girl. I am not a little girl. She's really trying hard to make herself sound important and authoritative, but just sounds like a young girl that's trying to shout.
Yeah.
And the whole point of her storming out because she's challenged with what is actually an incredibly valid question. Again, she's not prepared to...
No.
To hold a conversation like an adult, which because she's not.
Agreed. I mean, when I watched that, I was like, go to your room and think about what you've just done.
You do not send the leader of the Paku to their room.
No, you don't, but if you could, you would.
Yes. Yes. Actually, I've just had an image of Sisko doing exactly that. Go to your room and think about what you just done. Sorry. Go to your room and think about what you just done.
Yeah.
Much deeper voice.
Well, I think he would have insisted on think. Go to your room and think about what you've just done.
Yes.
Sorry, Avery Brooks.
Oh, dear. No hate mail, please. Varys heads out to the upper level of the promenade, where she encounters Nog and Jake. She tells the two of them about her land negotiations, but in a circumspect way, and Nog suggests that this could be an opportunity instead of a problem. An opportunity for what? Profit?
Profit, of course.
Yeah, not exactly the phrase I was expecting to come out of Nog's mouth, but yeah, definitely not something I would have expected Nog to have said, because it actually made sense.
Yeah.
Mm.
But he's a Ferengi, so... But Nog is far from being stupid.
Oh, no. I would imagine the younger you are, the more intelligent and crafty you're likely to be.
Spoiler, he's going to be a Starfleet officer.
What? I knew that. But our listeners may not have done. Mm.
What? We have listeners?
Nope, not anymore. They've all gone. Except Lainey. Lainey's still here. We love you, Lainey!
But that's because it's in her job description.
It's in the communication officer's contract. She's not permitted to leave ops. Both Jake and Nog suggest talking to her parents, but she sadly reports that both her parents were killed by the Cardassians during the occupation. Jake tells her his mother has also died in a battle with the Borg, and then they all get chased off again by Odo. But how vulnerable did she appear there? We saw the real Varys there.
Yeah, she appeared like a child,
right,
who has lost her parents.
Which is exactly who she is. This is her with no filter, with no mask on, trying to almost pretend, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but she is effectively pretending to be a leader of a race, of a faction, of a community of people.
Absolutely,
because she's not made for it. We know we can see this. On the planet, neither Bashir nor O'Brien can figure out what the strange creature was, nor how it was controlled. Bashir takes the opportunity to tease O'Brien before some of the villagers arrive bearing gifts and offering services, apparently including his choice of beautiful young women.
Yeah.
Awkward.
O'Brien didn't get the offer right away. Bashir had to explain.
That says more about Bashir than it does about O'Brien.
Yeah. Yes.
When O'Brien says he is a married man, Farron insists that O'Brien bring his wife and daughter down to the village to live with him. As he exits, the Seer's previous apprentice, Hovath, stares at O'Brien with undisguised hatred. The only thing they can do is figure out what the Dalaroq is and destroy it.
Yeah.
Which is probably a violation of the Prime Directive, just saying.
They're on Bajor. So they have passed first contact and Prime Directive and stuff like that.
Does the Prime Directive only occur, only take effect during first contact, or does it affect any civilization that they encounter?
That's a good point.
We need an expert in Starfleet regulations. Or Federation regulations, yes. Really.
We need Ro.
Oh, he would know.
Yeah, he would.
He's got the regulations, hasn't he? In a book. I've seen that on his shelf of Federation Starfleet
probably,
documentation.
Yeah.
Next to the schematics for the Enterprise E, probably.
Yes. I tried to buy the DS9 technical manual, but I couldn't find it on Amazon. So.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. I still have the next gen technical manual, I think, and the Enterprise E blueprint.
Mm. One ship
deck by deck.
Deck by deck, yes. One ship I would like to know about because it is, I think it only appears in, is it two episodes of TNG? And that's the Enterprise C. Mirror Universe, I believe, as well.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. In the movies, it's the original one and the 1701A in the first movies. And then in Generation, it's the 1701B?
Yes. In Generations, it was the Enterprise B under John Harriman, the one where Kirk was killed.
Yeah.
And it was in the same film that the D was destroyed.
Yeah.
As well.
And they had the E in the subsequent
movies. Yeah, it was the next one from after the D was destroyed on...
And I think we talked about that on Telegram. We had exchanged that this scene where the Enterprise crashes for the time for 90 something?
Generations was 94, I think.
94. Mm. So it's like 25 years ago.
Yeah, 27 years.
Yeah. The special effects were awesome.
Oh, yeah. The Enterprise D crashing on Viridian 3 was a phenomenal piece of special effects.
Yeah.
Really was good.
Dear listeners, if you have the occasion, check that on your favorite video hosting service.
Yes.
USS Enterprise. USS NCC-1701D crash landing.
Yep.
It is awesome.
Or watch Generations. I know it is not a very well thought of film. It's not particularly high up in people's opinions. But I actually think it's one of the best films I've seen, certainly.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. It's all the good things between the original series and Next Generation kind of rolled up into one nice, neat package. And Spot. Right, so we are on to Act 4.
Yes, indeed.
On DS9, they have just completed a second day of talks between the Paku and the Navat. Jake and Nog visit Varys again, but she is very much preoccupied with the negotiations. Just as the two boys turn to leave, she asks, "How can you be sure that an opportunity is worth the risk?" Nog quotes to her the ninth rule of acquisition, opportunity plus instinct equals profit. This rings a bell for her, and she says that helps, even though Jake and Nog still don't know what her problem actually is. Nog decides to celebrate with a practical joke and drags the other two to Odo's office with a Cardassian security rod that Nog has stolen to steal Odo's bucket. In the office, Nog tells them to watch the front door and then heads to look for the bucket. After a moment, he comes running out, trips, and the contents of the bucket spill onto a horrified Jake. But the joke is on Jake. The contents are not Odo, but oatmeal. Ugh. Nog... Oh, don't get me wrong, I love porridge, but that just looked disgusting. Yeah. Odo meal. Hey!
Yeah. Hey!
Let me see. I wonder if it's possible to turn every DS9 character into some form of food. We've got Auberge Noir stew from like two episodes ago, and then we've got Odo meal from this one.
And the glass, when Odo turned into a glass and... was it last week's episode or the week before? The week before. That's the
one Grand that Nagus, was just the Nagus one. Yeah.
Yes. No. Yes. Yes. The one with the Nagus.
Yes. Nog begins laughing and the others join in until Odo walks into the office and takes the bucket from Nog, who, in attempting to escape, runs headlong into Sisko.
Boing.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't turn as well as they wanted, but they had fun.
They did have fun, but the look on Sisko's face, there was very much a case of, nah.
This time it's too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, you know, when Nog fell and the content of the bucket got on Jake. I was like, for a split second, I was like, no, no.
No, but I presume that the contents of the bucket were Odo in it would have looked like what he turns into when he's shifting.
Yeah.
It's this, that, yep, slimy, effervescent, slimy, gloopy whammy stuff. Yes. Slimy, whimy, spacey, basic, wobbly, slimy, whimy.
Yes. Yes. Something like that. Yeah.
No, you can't turn everything into a Doctor Who joke. I'm sorry. I shall learn from this. Back on Bajor, Bashir and O'Brien continue to search for any hints of what the Dalrock might be when they are approached by a woman wanting her baby blessed by the Seera. O'Brien leaves Bashir to distract the crowd and heads back to the Seera's home. There, Hovath approaches O'Brien, and whilst O'Brien continues to search, draws a dagger and lunges at O'Brien. Instinct saves him, and they struggle for a moment until Bashir enters the room and gets between the two combatants. Hovath is disarmed and tells O'Brien that he is not the true Seera, and that Hovath is.
Yeah. Was it Instinct, or I thought... I've seen this episode earlier this late last week. Was it a mirror or something?
There was a mirror, but I think the mirror was for our purposes, so that we could see that Hovath was behind him. But he was looking in, some kind of jewelry box or something. But there was no indication that he saw... Okay. I didn't see an indication that O'Brien saw Hovath in the reflection. He kind of was like and then turned around.
Okay, so Instinct. Sold for Instinct.
Sold for Instinct. That's twice now Instinct's being used in this episode. It's obviously very important.
Yes, very important. Mm. That fight scene was... Yeah. A fight scene between actors not used to do fight scenes. So...
No.
But I'm not going to spend time on that.
What can you expect, really?
Yeah.
So we are already, would you believe, onto Act 5. Hovath explains his apprenticeship to O'Brien and Bashir and told how he was unable to control the Dalrock 3 nights ago. He then shows them a bracelet that apparently contains a fragment of one of the orbs from the Celestial Temple. Hovath continues his story, telling them of the first Seera, back when the village was split by hatred and mistrust, and how he used the fragment to create the Dalrock, and thus give their fears a physical form, and force the villagers to work together to defeat it. O'Brien gives the Seera's robe to Hovath, but Farron enters and tells Hovath that he has failed before, and would not be allowed to endanger the village again.
So, do you think this Dalrock is related to the Tar monster that we saw on Next Gen, the one that killed Tashayar, which was born from everyone's hatred and anger and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. It's probably not related, except maybe they have like a pool of pre-made scenarios and they draw monsters created by people's fears. Okay.
I'm just trying to remember that.
That's the episode where Tasha was killed.
Yeah.
When Riker went down into the star pit.
Right. It was like a river of black goop.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember that.
And that was created by the previous inhabitants' fears and anger and they got rid of that and they elevated themselves to some kind of superior state or whatever. What happened? I don't remember exactly what happened.
It fed on the fears of the people that it encountered. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So either it's a cheap reuse of the same. Of the same construct, or it's something just completely different. But it's a good comparison.
Somebody found the post-it that was used for the Next Gen scenario, and then, oh, that's a good story. Let's do another one.
Unless somebody forgot to stamp on it. Done that.
Yeah. then. Oh well.
Never mind. I don't care because Miles is happy.
Yes.
Chief O'Brien had a smile on his face because he knew that he wasn't going to be doing this anymore.
Well, bad luck.
Yeah, about that. Back on DS9, in his office, Sisko listens to Varys as she takes responsibility for the actions of Jake and Nog in the security office earlier, telling him that they were just trying to impress her. She tells him that she was trying to learn more about him and that Jake thought very highly of his father. Her own father, she says, was a great man who had been feared by the Nevot. Turning the conversation back to the talks, she admits that she has been trying to be as strong as he was. He could afford to make compromises because the Nevot feared him, but she would not have the same luxury appearing weak. She supposes you don't lose by saying no. But Sisko remarks that great leaders know when to risk saying yes. This prompts her to suggest that she may have an opportunity, which she got that phrase from,
yeah,
that allows both sides to say yes.
Yeah. I think she stated exactly what happened. She was trying to be like her father and be as strong as he was and things like that, but she's not her father. For the simple reason that she's very much younger first, but even if she was the same age, she's not her father, so she has to do stuff her way and not try and imitate somebody else's way, because obviously that doesn't fit her character.
Yeah, I think it goes one stage further than that. Yes, it is very important that she does things her way and doesn't try to copy those that have walked before her. But at the same time, she's also learning to take advice from people around her in order to help her make those decisions. I think one of the biggest things that you will see of, let's call them leaders of any kind, is if they try and do things by themselves, then they will either fail or they will be despised. But if you use the people around you and take their advice and consider the wills and desires of the people, you're much more likely to have a positive outcome. Even if it's not what you wanted, there's a compromise in there somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I should do motivational speaking. No.
You should be a Sira.
Yeah, but I think the Dalrock would just go away bored, say, I'm not going back there again.
Yeah, so we see that Varys is beginning to change. You know, maybe Nog has a good influence after all.
She's growing up. That's what this proves. She has grown up.
Yes.
Back in the village, O'Brien is reluctantly getting ready to tell the story. The crowd urges him on as he reaches the platform, but he is clearly not comfortable. He begins to tell the story, badly, as the Dalrock makes its appearance, but there is no sign of the sparkling lights to fight off the Dalrock. That was painful to watch. I really felt for O'Brien because he didn't have a clue what he was doing.
Yeah. No, and everybody was looking at him and nobody was doing anything. And he was like, I'm trying.
It's the Dalrock. And he points and goes, yeah, it's there. Oh, thanks for pointing that one out. I couldn't see it before.
We can see that. Yeah. Clearly it was not. But I think it was a way for us viewers to realize that indeed it was not his place, so it might have been a little bit exaggerated, but so it's clearly not the Sira, and we know that, you know, by what is happening next. But if you were O'Brien is not fitted for that,
right?
As we said earlier. Yeah. You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess, as you said, would that have been Bashir? That would have been brilliant. Still not the real Sierra, but it would have been brilliant.
But I don't think that would have mattered. As long as you can waffle your way through.
Yeah.
Because this isn't about the Sierra, this is about the people. It's about getting the support and the love and the energy from the people to battle the Dalrock away. All the Sierra isn't doing anything to the Dalrock. The people are. The Sierra drives the people.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt at all, Bashir could do that. No doubt in my mind whatsoever.
Yes.
And we already know that O'Brien can't.
Yes. Yeah. I need to put a post-it on something and come back to that later.
Okay. Meanwhile, Bashir encourages Hovath to step up to his true role, and that the prior Sira had probably chosen O'Brien so that Hovath could rescue him and thus regain the confidence of the villagers. As the Dalrock comes in for the final attack, Hovath rushes onto the platform, grabs the bracelet from O'Brien, and begins to tell the story, brimming with confidence. The lights appear, and the Dalrock is driven off and defeated once again. Bashir and O'Brien quietly, well, not really, make their escape.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to come back on, is that, in fact, the previous Sierra, I think he chose O'Brien exactly because he was not fit for the role.
Yeah.
Because he knew the previous one would not be accepted by the villagers unless he was able to rescue the one. And that's probably also why he didn't choose Bashir, because it maybe sensed that Bashir could actually have done it. Yeah,
totally.
So it chose the less likely to succeed, the less likely person to succeed. The person less likely to succeed.
Which is almost exactly what the Nagas did.
Yeah.
The Nagas used Quark to try and get, forgotten his name, to prove his worth. Obviously that failed, but this one didn't.
Yep.
Back on the station, Varys is walking through the promenade with Sisko, nervous about the compromise she is going to suggest, giving the Navolt their land, but allowing free access to the river for the Parku. They encounter Jake and Nog, watched by Odo, of course, and she thanks them both, giving Nog a kiss on the cheek. Odo walks the two boys... Sorry.
Yeah, if he could have blushed behind... You know, if the prosthetics could have blushed, it would have been all red.
Yeah. I'm a little bit disappointed. I thought she was going to go and give Jake a kiss as well, but no... Yeah. Little something there, maybe.
Yeah.
Odo walks the two boys to the security office to clean up the mess they left. Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
That is going to be a nightmare to clean. Because if that's dry, that's like glue.
Yes, indeed. Mm. And that's probably everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Nasty. Just then, Bashir and O'Brien arrive back on the station. Bashir is interested in telling people about what happened, well, duh, but O'Brien has had quite enough of storytelling for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure Bashir is going to talk about that for a month.
Well, we know what his storytelling is like and how tall his stories are. So, yeah, he'll use one for a while.
Yeah.
And then finally, Bashir informs O'Brien that he is not required to call him Julian.
Yay!
Why would you even say that? It's all right, minion. You don't have to call me Julian. I would rather you called me Sir from now on. I didn't see the point.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
But O'Brien was relieved.
I don't get it. I think they're making too much of the of that part of thing. What you often find is in the in the not command ranks, there tends to be a lot more informality in when people are addressing each other. It's usually only in the command ranks that the use of titles is required, encouraged. But I don't know, I would have expected that a chief petty officer and a medical chief would have bantered. There again, I'm not sure that O'Brien is the bantering type.
No. No, I don't see O'Brien spending, you know, the best part of the night at the bar drinking with Bashir. You know, I'm not sure.
No. So. No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, but...
So, what did you think of that episode, Yannick?
I was a bit split on this episode. I like the Darroch part of the story and the fact that O'Brien was completely out of place as the supposedly new Syrah. But the whole part with what's her name? Varys. Varys. I didn't really like this one. I didn't really care about this one. It didn't bring, you know, bring anything to the whole story. I thought it was really the B plot, and I thought like they didn't make a lot of effort on this second part. But the story on Bajor with the Darroch and the Syrah and the fact that he chose O'Brien and all the questions as to, you know, what is the Darroch? Why did he choose O'Brien? Why was Bashir rejected? Will O'Brien stay there and stuff like all that? That was interesting. The other part, you know, a little bit less.
I wasn't sure why those two stories were in the same episode, because there was no link between them at all. They were completely separated stories. I wonder if, from a storytelling perspective, and I should probably look this up, whether from a storytelling perspective, they only had two short stories that they wanted to convey, and they thought, do you know what, we'll fit both of those in one episode and see how it goes. Well, probably. It didn't.
I would rather have a more fleshed out story about the Darroch and how the first Syrah came to create it and things like that, rather than have this story with the boys and the girl.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, personally, I think the episode was good. I had no complaints with it. I think the two stories in and of themselves were fine. Again, no issues with them whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I just don't understand why they would have put the two of them in the same episode if there was no join between them. Very often when they do this, they'll put two seemingly disparate and unconnected storylines together in the same place, but then right at the very end they'll converge and you'll get this kind of big reveal that makes sense, that maybe Varys was the Syrah's granddaughter or so. I don't know, but something like that. But there was none of that at all.
No, I understand what you mean. Yeah, it was just too many stories. So one was better than the other.
Right. One thing that did stand out for me is Colm Meaney is a really, really good actor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but, and indeed very well underused in Next Gen.
Absolutely.
And his character is really developing, and we can see how good an actor he is in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Yeah. But for him to act, so badly during the Darroch scene where he was acting as the Syrah, that must have been really difficult for him to do, because you're acting well to act badly.
Indeed.
Does that make sense?
It's like, yes, it's like singers who have to sing wrong for some movies or TV, and then become better, and that takes talent to, you know, voluntarily sing wrong and or play wrong, as you mentioned.
Mm.
So yeah,
excellent.
Ireland Got Talent.
Yes, indeed. Excellent. Well, I've got a couple of small items of trivia from this episode.
Okay.
Probably nothing we haven't already spoken about in some
mentioned.
Way.
Yeah.
Hang on. Just managed to open up a link. Didn't mean to do that. The village, the Sera village on Bajor, mm-hmm. Was actually constructed for that episode.
Ah,
it wasn't a reuse of a TNG.
Nope.
A
TNG
set. No.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we got? Apparently, Alexander Siddig and Colm Meaney really enjoyed doing that episode together. It was the first episode in which the two characters had a lot of scenes in the same at the same time. Colm Meaney is actually quoted to have said, it established our relationship and made us much closer as characters. But actually, seemed as though it did the exact opposite. It pushed the two apart as characters.
Well, you know, when you don't know someone and then you have to be with that person for a certain amount of time, the first impression might not be, you know, you might not be best buddy with that person straight away. But, you know, it's like when you say there's no such thing as bad publicity. It's you may have, before you didn't have any relationship with that person, and then you have that I don't like you relationship with that person. But then you might realize, well, you know what, maybe not like that person as much as I thought, you know, because it's always the same thing. It's someone new, you know. It's like you have your friends and stuff like that, and then suddenly someone new comes around,
right?
And it is a natural reaction to, yeah, okay, that this new person is there. I don't know that person as much as the others, so yeah, no, okay, you're the new one, but then you start to know that person, and then the relationship gets better. So I guess the relationship between the two characters, it may have started like that, but then they are now aware of each other, of
a bit
what
like
they like and
a,
they don't
a
like
a bit like Odo and Quark,
yeah,
in a way.
Except Odo and Quark know each other from Terraknor, from the Cardassian occupation. So
yes,
they've known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
A couple of other things. We mentioned the one of the rules of acquisition, number 9, opportunity plus instinct mm-hmm. equals profit. This episode marked the first appearance of Odo's bucket. We have finally met Odo's bucket.
Yes.
Excellent. And this is the second episode in which we've seen Odo smile.
Yes.
He smiled in indeed. Vortex, which was the mm-hmm. the episode that we published a few days ago. And in both of the cases where we saw Odo smile, both in Vortex and also in this episode, is when he was interacting with children.
Yes. Is it a sign or something? Hmm.
I don't know, but
I don't know.
We don't know enough about Odo to understand anything about his past. But if he finds he can relate better with children than he can with adults, then it's something to look out for.
Indeed.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
All right. Anything else you want to mention?
No. No, no.
Right.
I'm good.
Did you want to do a trivia bookie thing, or...?
Yeah, well, as we're looking into the book, but it's mostly about stuff in the next seasons, in the following season. So I guess we're going to leave the books there for a while and maybe finish the first season of DS9 before we start the trivia. Maybe we can get the trivia when we do the DS9 extravaganza.
Ah, now that would be fun. We'll have to find a way of... Of handling answers.
We're going to have guests who have seen the whole DS9, so we can ask those questions.
Indeed so. Okay, well, on that basis then, we shall end our review of Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 1, Episode 14, The Storyteller. Thanks to all of you for listening to our show. You can help us spread the love for this podcast by going on a road trip in a minivan and then spending 8 hours telling every passenger how great our show is and why they should listen to it before you bore them to death. Or, if you think they might turn on you and shorten your lifespan prematurely, you can simply share the address of our website on social media.
Indeed, our website is at tergreyhut.org, where you can find our show notes, our reviews. Leave a comment for every episode in the little commenty thingy box under each episode. Show notes thing.
And you can leave us feedback by email. Our address is feedback@tlgreyhot.org. And please do not forget, that is one of the ways you can submit to us your suggestions for the little sign-offy things we do at the end of the show that we're starting to get a little bit dry on. Although that one was very good, I'll be honest. But please help us out. We're... Help.
Help. I need somebody. Help.
Oh, careful. Copyright strike.
Oops, sorry. We are also on Twitter and Facebook, thanks to Lainey, our communication officer. Yeah. Our username for both of those is TEGHpodcast, and we are also on Telegram at t.me/TEGHpodcast. And we also stream the recordings of those episodes on Twitch at twitch.tv/TEGHpodcast. I love how consistent we are with our username.
Yeah, except our web address.
Except that.
Yeah. Word. Thanks as always to Memory Alpha. We have based our review of this week's episode on their work, and that is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution non-commercial license.
The rest of the show is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution share-like license. See our website for details, and if you can find the page, let us know, because... think we've lost it.
I'm sure it's there somewhere. I've never seen it, but I have some, confidence that it is there. And of course,
maybe it will be.
We've been saying that for such a long time.
It will be in the past when the time traveling lawnmower comes back.
Yeah, absolutely. Along with the 7 question answers.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, this podcast is a proud member of the Other Side Podcast Network. You can check out more of our shows around the network over at otherside.network.
Our next episode will be a review of Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 1, Episode 15, Progress. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Will you be back next week, Dave?
I would imagine so. I hope so. Why?
You're invited.
Something you want to tell me?
No. Oh. So, we will be back next week with Dave, with a whole lot more Star Trek. In the meantime, make sure you save that COVID certificate in a safe place, keep your masks on, and take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See ya, if I'm allowed back.
A member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.